Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:05 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is November 1st. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off this week and point out a rather interesting, or at least it's a point that I find interesting, about investor psychology. Gold prices started moving higher in June, July, and August. But what we're seeing now in October is that sales of American Eagle gold coins are back trending higher again. That's something that we often see. It's usually that when prices are low, it's very difficult to encourage anybody to participate. When prices are high, investors are queuing up to buy. This is why you get cycles. It's also why you get trends. It's why you get accelerations that often represent the end of a trend, because the higher the price goes, the greater the fear is of missing out on future gains. And there is a powerful behavioral aspect to that kind of activity. It's something we see at the end of many bull markets. Well, what's probably interesting, I think, in terms of pointing this out, though, is that we're really only at the beginning of a bull market in commodities. When, for example, we look at the gold miners ETF, then even despite the fact that the price went from 20 to 30 in the space of about 7 or 8 weeks, it really is only just consolidating in the region of the upper side of this base formation that's been underway for 6 years. And it is still less than half the value it was back when it hit a peak in 2011. But perhaps the more important point is this looks like a base formation. In fact, it's looked like a first step above this type 2 base formation for the last 3 years. That's something that we see with precious metals. One of the reasons that people are really engaged with precious metals is because when someone has a worldview, particularly when that worldview is expressing caution at the profligacy of the elected class, then when gold does well, there is a certain form of vindication that people feel. But the other reason that people like to own gold is because when it goes, it really goes. And the move that we had in early 2016, where the gold miners ETF went from above 10 to above 30 in the space of about 6 months, was and a great example of just how far and fast gold shares can move. And we had a little replay of that in the middle of this year. In between these incredibly prolific periods, then gold and gold shares can tend to be range-bound. And that can be trying for patience. But the most important point to remember is that this continues to have a favorable chart pattern. And it means that there are going to be periods when gold and gold shares don't do much of anything, and there are going to be periods, and of course, there are going to be periods when it does a lot. And of course, there is the third alternative. There are definitely going to be periods when gold scares investors who already have positions, because it is a volatile instrument, and it is best bought following periods of volatility. I do think that when we just zoom in and look at the daily charts that we're seeing on gold shares, this looks like a pretty orderly consolidation. It has unwound most of the overextension relative to the trend mean and done so in a pretty steady manner. When, for example, we then look at silver, it's got a very similar pattern. It unwound most of the overextension relative to the trend mean, and now it is steadying once more. Well, it was looking rather foolhardy to be buying silver when it was back at $17 and had no evidence of having found support. But that's the problem with trying to apply what would normally be people's instinct to the volatility of commodity markets. The time when most people wanted to buy silver was in August, when it was surging higher. But it was then, because of that acceleration, the time when people were queuing up to buy, well, then that was obviously a time where the available demand portion of the market was being exhausted rather quickly. And it takes some time for that demand fuel to build up again in order to fuel the next leg of the of the bull market, and that can take a while. It can take months. In that period of time, then it can be kind of boring, and when people get bored, they tend to tighten stops. That contributes to volatility. When we look at the gold price, it has a very clearly, I think, well-defined rounding characteristic to this six-year base formation. The $1,350 area was the upper side of the base. It has been completed. This looks like a first consolidation within a new bull market. This is one of the most important points that I think is different in this bull market, because we're seeing gold rallying and being really quite firm against a background where stock markets are hitting new all-time highs. And conventional thinking would suggest that with the stock markets doing so well, then there should be less demand for a hedge against inflation, or a hedge against deflation, or hence a hedge against calamity, like gold. But the point is, of course, that one of the reasons why the stock market is doing well is because the US government is running a $1 trillion deficit, because they have been cutting interest rates three times so far this year. They are now back engaging in liquidity provision. They don't want to call that quantitative easing, because what they've effectively done is to take over the private sector's participation in the repo market. That, if they create that as a standing repo facility, then that opens up the Federal Reserve's balance sheet to unlimited liability. I don't think that's something that anyone is really willing to consider today, but obviously that it does represent a potential problem somewhere out there in the future. Monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. Therefore, we are back in a liquidity-rich environment. That's particularly true when, for example, we look at the pressure that is coming through on the TED spread. And I will define what the TED spread is in a moment, but the more important point is pushing higher, and it was higher again in here today. Now, these levels are still rather inconsequential compared to where they were back in 2006 and 7, but I think anybody can see here that there was a clear downtrend all the way from the beginning of 2018. That has been broken. There is now a rounding characteristic evident in the chart, and it does look like it's moving higher. Well, if we simply look at the spread, well, what it is effectively is taking the three-month LIBOR rate and the three-month Treasury bill, and taking one from the other. In other words, the higher the spread goes, the greater the demand on an additional premium from the banking sector is being required by the market. So it is highlighting that there is increasing risk within the financial system. Now, we're not seeing that when we look at the banking sector. The S&P 500 banks, for example, has broken up and out of its range. This is really very encouraging activity. It suggests that there is a solid foundation for the breakout that we're seeing on Wall Street. Now, there is a couple of additional points to support that argument. For example, some of the worst performing shares. If we simply look at the S&P 500 and the best and worst performing shares this year, well, we're going to be presented with Macy's, for example, has been down 47%. Lam Research, Advanced Micro Devices have been among the best performers. What's interesting is Coty was one of the worst performers last year, one of the best performers this year. When we look at the Dow Jones, then what's particularly interesting today is that some of the worst performers for the year, like Walgreens and 3M, have been the best performers today. And I thought that was rather interesting. Now, when we look at, for example, 3M, then it has massively underperformed the wider market over the last 2 years. It's done nothing but go down, while the wider market has been going sideways to up. It is now steadying from the $150 area, and there is the potential that it may be able to break this downtrend, and that's still a potential rather than a confirmationary move. GE, which went from just over 30 at the beginning of 2017, bottomed out around 7 at the beginning of this year. It's still only around $10 or so. About $10 right now. So it still has got some work to do, but certainly this week's upper dynamic suggests that the good news is outweighing the bad news in the short term. Then when, for example, we look at some of the companies that have also been selling off aggressively, like Kraft Heinz. Well, it popped on the upside yesterday. It was able to improve on that performance in here today. And it is now breaking that sequence of lower rally highs. And the lower rally highs have been in evidence now for almost 2.5 years. Well, what that is suggesting is that there is evidence of some bargain hunting going on. People are looking at the kinds of companies that have had, the clearest pattern that has unified shares like Kraft Heinz, GE, and 3M over the course of the last few years has been the writing off of intangible valuations attached to those shares. In other words, the veil of mystique around the balance sheets for these companies has been pierced. And what it is in fact doing is creating this emperor has no clothes downtrend, saying that in fact the valuation that was attached to the prestige and value of their brands is in fact worth nothing. But of course, they are cash flow generative businesses. It's not as if their businesses have completely evaporated. It's rather that the interpretation of the value of their intangible assets has been, addressed or doubted. But the question now is whether that is beginning to come to a conclusion, coming to an end, because we're starting to see at least some evidence of steadying coming through. We're also at the point where if the wider stock market is breaking on the upside, then it is natural for investors to start to think about, well, do I go off and buy, for example, Microsoft or Apple, which are among the best performers this year and are in incredibly powerful trends? Or should I buy something like GE, which has had the massive decline? Well, there are times when these kinds of value plays can be rewarding. They're less likely to be rewarding when we think about them in terms of the persistence of an uptrend over the course of a secular bull market or a medium-term bull market. But that doesn't mean that the log scale doesn't help them to outperform in short bursts. And I suspect that that's what we're starting to get now, that investors are willing to look at these industrial companies that have been written down so aggressively. Well, that also is supportive of the view that it is cyclicals, and industrials are certainly cyclical, that do tend to do well from very low levels in the latter stages of bull markets. We do anticipate that cyclicals should stage impressive recoveries in the latter stages of a bull market, and they do not represent lead indicators for the end of a bull market. In fact, what they often do is they peak well after the peak in the wider market. Well, the classic example of cyclical shares that generally do that kind of thing are commodities. But when, for example, we look at the FTSE 350 mining index, which is, I think, one of the best ways of thinking about it, then it hasn't really been doing much of anything, but it was stronger in here today. Now, we have the V reversal back in 2015 and 2016, and it has been ranging mostly below 20,000 for the last couple of years. If it can push up and through that 20,000 level, well, then we will have some evidence that we're getting the mining sector also paying attention here to the recovery in cyclicals. The continuous commodity index has finally put in an upward dynamic, and it has now clearly broken the downtrend over the course of the last 18 months. Well, what this is supportive of is that commodities do have the potential to start to play catch up. This is was I think one of the major missing ingredients we've had over the course of the last 2 years, that industrials and commodities had been underperforming by such a wide margin that it was sapping interest. It was also creating this interpretation of the outlook for the market that because commodities and industrials were doing so badly, that it was representative of a major slowdown in demand on the global front. But there is another way of thinking about it. It is that commodities have been working off the excesses of the bull market, that there is still plenty of supply. And a lot of commodity businesses are heavily reliant on China more than any other economy, and therefore it is more about a slowdown in China, a slowdown in Chinese infrastructure development and property markets that has been the factor that's inhibited the growth in demand for commodities. And then it's been this attack on intangible assets that's been a major factor for the industrials, and not least because of their additional exposure to the global economy. But then when we think about the other factors that are helping to drive this market higher right now, well, you've got the semiconductors index, which has very clearly now broken up and through the 1600 point level. This has been looking like a bullish consolidation for most of the last 6 months, and now we are pushing up and away. What's, I think, rather obvious here is that the pace of the advance is picking up. Even if we were to look at this on a logarithmic scale chart and just go back for some history, we can still observe that the pace of the advance is picking up. But what I think is also really worth highlighting is a little bit like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Something that we're starting to see being a view that's being touted, something that a lot of investors are now beginning to talk about, has been that, yes, the pace of growth in this expansion has not been as impressive as it has been in other expansions. And that could potentially result in this expansion being longer than other expansions. There's the additional point being made that because of these little mini recessions, and the most recent of those may now just be being concluded, but certainly the pause in 2015 and 16 was considered to be a mini recession. If people are thinking, well, these little mini recessions allow some of the excess to be worked off, they also avoid the formation of bubbles, and therefore there is the scope for earnings growth to re-accelerate, the global economy to come out of this funk, the trade war to improve, and that then helping to fuel the next leg higher. Well, that kind of rationale, I think, is rather compelling. But what it also tells us is that investors are coming around to the idea that this market is capable of ranging for 2 years and then breaking higher. Because we've seen it do it now on three separate occasions. And three is a bit of a magic number when it comes to cycle recognition for humans. We tend to look at one or two examples as maybe a coincidence, but when you get three examples, people automatically tend to think of it as a pattern. And the uptrend that we're seeing now in the semiconductors index is really quite compelling. Now, we can also see that it is starting to pick up pace. When we throw a 1,000-day moving average or a 200-week moving average on the chart, well, we can see that it is now as overextended relative to the trend mean as it was all the way back at the beginning of 2017 at least. What this is suggesting is that we are moving into the acceleration phase, and that's consistent with a bubble. But I think, like George Soros says, you trade the bubble. There's no evidence yet that this bull market is in fact over. But we are getting signs that it is getting late in the cycle. I think that the closest comparison that we have right now is what we saw back in the period between about 1995 and 1998. Back then, it was in 1995, we had two interest rate cuts, then we had an interest rate hike, and then we had another cut. That wasn't enough of tightening to really kill off the bull market. It was when they got really worried about Y2K and started raising rates aggressively into the bubbly phase that we had on the NASDAQ, then that was when that eventually did kill off the animal spirits. If we look at what that meant for the NASDAQ going all the way back to 1995, 1995 saw the index at 554, and it peaked a lot closer to 4,500. So it went up 9 times in that period. The real bubbly phase was between about 1998 and early 2000, where it went from 1,000 up to 4,500. Now, we haven't yet had that kind of spectacular advance, but it doesn't mean that we can't have it. I think one of the most important points about the agonizing that a lot of value investors have gone on with regard to the cyclically adjusted P/E ratio produced by Shiller, is that it's at the second highest level in history. But the other way of thinking about that is that it's only at the second highest level in history. The last time, it was really about the evolution of the technology sector, or the technology, media, and telecommunications sectors. And that was really as it applied to the US and European economies. Well, this bull market today is about the global economy. It's, instead of looking at approximately about 800 million people, it's looking more like at approximately 5 billion people. And that's still allowing for about 2 billion people that aren't attached to the global economy at all. Well, What that suggests is that we are potentially now at the bubble phase, that the pace of the advance is picking up. It is being led higher by the data companies. But I think the most important point is that we have got ranges, one above another. And these ranges can last for upwards of 2 years. And I think one of the shares that many people will be particularly interested in is going to be Amazon, because it has been such a spectacular performer. But most particularly, it has been the share which has worked best from a buy the dips perspective, all the way up from the lows in 2008. And that also is supportive of the view that people bought the dip at the in or at least in the middle of December last year, and they've been buying the dip over the course of the last few weeks. When we look at this on just a simple daily chart, it has bounced from 1700, and it needs to do better than that. It needs to push up and through the $1800 area. As the leading share, I think Amazon needs to push on to new high ground to confirm that we are still in a broad bull market environment. The one problem that we are seeing among a number of the e-commerce companies is Etsy, for example, has pulled back in a very violent manner this week. eBay is also well below its peak, so and pulled back rather violently over the course of the last 2 weeks. Well, these are periods of underperformance that we're seeing in companies that are heavily levered to the health of the consumer, and they're not doing particularly well. Whereas it is very data-driven companies, particularly those that have adopted a subscription business model, that are doing spectacularly well. The payments processors like Visa continue to trend higher in a persistent manner. We're also starting to see Microsoft doing very well following the adoption of its subscription business model. Adobe, though, which was really the pioneer of the subscription business model, is now right in the region of its trend mean. We're also starting to see that some of the cloud computing companies are doing better. When we think about the performance of the ETF, then it's right in the region of its trend mean. When we think then about some of the original cloud computing companies like Citrix Systems, then it is bouncing from that trend mean and has clearly broken its sequence of lower rally highs, and that is really quite strong confirmation that the medium-term low is in. What we're therefore starting to see is that the original leaders in this bull market are now breaking higher. Then we're seeing evidence of catch-up. Some of the catch-up plays are happening in the commodity sector. That's one of the reasons why the continuous commodity index has started to do better. It's also why gold has started to do better. If agricultural commodities are starting to perform, then some of the agricultural commodity or fertilizer companies, for example, are extremely low at the present time. Mosaic, for example, is back testing its lows from 2017 and is a fraction of where it was trading back in 2011. And even then, that is way below where it was trading at the top of the market in 2008. So there is, I think, an argument that a base has been put in over the course of the last 4 years. But of course, it's going to have to break its sequence of lower rally highs to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Again, these are the kinds of companies that I suspect people will be looking at if, for example, the trade war does get at least a partial resolution, and China does in fact start to buy more US commodities, Archer Daniels Midland should also be able to successfully hold this move above the trend mean. But this is also one of the reasons why investors are starting to look further afield. They're looking, for example, at Europe. The Europe stocks 600 is now right in the region of the psychological 400 point level. It's been ranging mostly below this region for the last 5 years, but that range started all the way back in early 2000. The more important point is that the range that's happened over the course of the last 5 years is substantially in the region of the upper side of this long consolidation. We did not go all the way back down to test the 175 area, which is what happened after 2000 and 2007. Well, what that suggests is that investors are beginning to look at Europe as a potential catch-up play on what we're seeing in Wall Street, that Wall Street's has a leash effect. We haven't really talked about the Wall Street leash effect in a really quite significant time because there wasn't much evidence of it. The massive performance that we were seeing in terms of outperformance, really, for the U.S. markets, was not translating into performance for other markets because of the uncertainty with regard to how Europe is attempting to both create a federal union while also simultaneously trying to equalize the debt to GDP ratios of a whole host of countries with different priorities and different economic models. Nobody said this was going to be easy, but investors, well, they will always go to where the assets have the best opportunity to appreciate. It is only by virtue of a catch-up play that you can make a clear and the Wall Street leash effect that you can make a clear argument for why Europe should, in fact, be catching up. But there is the additional point that the euro has been starting to firm. Now, we've had a little consolidation in the region of the trend mean. The dollar is the linchpin, in terms of this argument. The reason why there hasn't been a Wall Street leash effect over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, even though the Nasdaq, the semiconductors index, have been successfully hitting new highs, is because of the strength of the dollar and the interest rate differential that the USA has enjoyed. Well, it's unlikely that the interest rate differential between the USA and Europe is going to narrow much further. But they have cut interest rates, and they are increasing the size of the balance sheet. And then there is the issue of deficits. And that's, I think, one of the primary reasons why gold is doing better, because deficits are in fashion. And there is a lot of talk about the fact that when you do have a recession, then interest rates generally tend to fall by about 400 basis points, give or take 50 basis points. When you have interest rates that are already at zero or close to zero, in the USA, then that means there has to be additional extraordinary measures deployed. Well, we're already seeing what those extraordinary measures are. There has been very, very clearly a decision to deploy the extraordinary measures early in order to try and avoid the recession. So we're seeing a massive fiscal stimulus occurring in the USA at the same time that the economy is at full employment and growth is still positive. And if that's not a recipe for a bubble, I don't know what is. And that is, I think, the clearest argument that anyone might hope for, that we are seeing the end of a 2-year consolidation. Ranges are explosions waiting to happen. This is a well-defined range, and it is looking increasingly likely that it is going to break on the upside. That doesn't necessarily mean that the dollar is going to continue to do well from here. There is still a clear ambition by politicians in the USA in particular to extend deficits. It is, I think, in my view at least, increasingly likely that Elizabeth Warren is going to become the Democratic nominee. And she has a very clear tax and spend set of policies. Her ambitions, of course, are to create Medicare for All, which would be the equivalent of the USA's, of the UK's National Health Service. And that is going to represent a key challenge for her administration, considering the opposition that it faces in both houses, including from her own party. Of course, the anybody to try and get elected on the prospect of raising taxes is obviously going to have a great deal of difficulty. But the bigger picture is that any plan that eventually has gains enough of support to make it through Congress is unlikely to, in fact, raise taxes or be revenue positive. Rather, it's much more likely that we're going to see again and a further iteration in terms of fiscal profligacy. And that does appear now to be adding up to an argument for why the dollar does not need to be quite so strong. That was it's beginning to be evident in Europe, but of course Europe doesn't want a strong currency either. The Japanese yen was strong yesterday. It's right in the region of the trend mean. The Japanese don't want to have a stronger currency either. China has been allowing the renminbi to strengthen over the course of the last 2 months. I suspect, though, that they're going to be rather unwilling to allow it to strengthen through 7. Where we are starting to see, though, some evidence of the dollar giving up its strength is against some of the weaker commodity currencies. If commodities have, in fact, broken their downtrend, which looks very likely, then the argument for why some of these commodity currencies can't do better becomes much less convincing, and the Australian dollar right now is pretty low. Now, one of the motivating factors behind the performance of the ASX 200 over the course of the last year has been the weakness of the Aussie dollar. It's also been a support for the mining sector. But a stronger Australian dollar generally tends to be better for the commodity complex because it is generally as a result of people wanting to buy the currency to gain some exposure to a bull market in commodities. And what that suggests is that there's likely to be some demand for Aussie dollars simply as to gain exposure to the potential for commodities to do better. Of course, we then also have to consider why are we still in a bull market? What is it that is motivating people to, in fact, go out and buy, to pay new all-time highs for shares, to support this incredible move that we've seen? Well, the answer is pretty simple. It's going to be, it's not just going to be, it has been technology-led. And the promises of what's possible in future continue to get progressively more ambitious. The pace of innovation in artificial intelligence is increasing at an exponential rate. The pace of innovation in CRISPR and in genetic editing is increasing at a beyond an exponential rate. And the pace of innovation in quantum computing is improving at an exponential rate. In other words, they're not talking about doubles, they're talking about exponents or squares. The simple way of thinking about that is that it's not going to be 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, but rather it's more like 1, 2, 4, 16, 256. That pace of innovation is very difficult for people to get their heads around, because it doesn't just create an exponential curve. People already have difficulty trying to figure out or trying to predict the pace of advance from an exponential curve. There's really no hope at all without the aid of a computer model to figure out what happens when you have an exponential curve. And I think there is this state of .AI report I'm posting in here today. One of the slides highlights the old story about the invention of chess, where an Indian prince had been looking for a game, and somebody came in with a chessboard. He asked, it was such a compelling game, he was asked what kind of reward he wanted. He said, "Well, all I want is if you put one grain on the first square and double it in the next square and double it in the next square, then I'll take that as my reward." And the prince said, "No problem." By the time his vizier had figured out, probably 5 minutes later, just how much grain would be in the last of the 64 squares, they decided to simply execute the inventor of chess rather than to pay out the entire wealth of the kingdom for the invention of the game. But of course, that's a great example of the inability of people to very simply appreciate what exponential growth means. When we start to think about exponential growth, then the pace of innovation in quantum computing is something that is very difficult to overestimate and extraordinarily easy to underestimate. When that is married up with the significant improvements we're seeing in the capabilities of algorithms and their predictive qualities, married with quantum computing, then that alone has the potential to deliver upon a lot of the promises that have been made with regard to artificial intelligence and machine learning. We're at a point today where we have a lot of data. The limitations of artificial intelligence, such as it is today, is about defining what that data is and labeling photographs, labeling various pieces of data so that a computer program can learn from it. That's one of the reasons why artificial intelligence has been so effective at becoming very good at computer games, because it's a very well-defined universe. The real world is not nearly as well-defined. And it is on that natural learning curve that I think we need to pay particular attention to, because computers are increasingly being designed to act like children. Children are massive sponges for information that can create conclusions from experience. And it is in that kind of evolution where the trend of autonomous vehicles is going. In the meantime, these are incredibly disruptive in terms of what it means for the regular economy. The provision of autonomous vehicles would result in mass unemployment for millions of people. At the same time, it would create incredible value in terms of the global economy, and entire new sectors would evolve as a result of it. Of course, it will increasingly ask the question, what is it that people will do when they do not have the technical expertise? This is one of the great challenges, I suspect, of our generation. we're at a period in history where the global population is probably going to peak sometime in the next 20 years. The birth rate has already peaked. What we're getting now is that the age of people is growing longer, people are living longer. That's contributing to population growth. It's in these 20 years where we need to figure out what to do with people. It'll probably be less of a compelling argument and less of a worry in 30 years' time because the global population will probably already have peaked, and therefore we won't have to worry quite as much about what people need to do. At the moment, life is cheap. 30 years from now, every life will become progressively more valuable because there will simply be fewer people. That isn't something that is a comfortable topic of conversation for people today, but unfortunately, it is a reality. When we look at the growth in geopolitical tensions, part of the reason for it is because certainly when we look at a number of the commodity producers, whether it is in South Africa where Eskom is on the verge of bankruptcy and is putting downward pressure on the South African rand, or whether it is in Chile where the absence of a diversified economy has been commented upon for years, but it took the bear market in copper prices, and that has been an incredibly persistent move, which has really brought to bear this inequality in the Chilean market. Then, of course, what's going on in Hong Kong is as a revolt against the inability of people from the city-state to, in fact, achieve a middle-class class lifestyle. This revolt against the status quo, this revolt against the inability of standards of governance to improve and the corruption of elected officials, this isn't something that's going to go away. It's a factor of the fact that millions of people have been left behind by technological innovation. They've been left behind by globalization. And their elected officials don't have the tools to really provide a sense of self-worth and I think an ability to create a narrative for personal value that is compelling enough for people to set aside their revolutionary tactics. Well, there is an election right now in the UK. We're going to find out in the next 6 weeks what the answer to that question is. But of course, there is this very strong likelihood that we could have another hung parliament. And that is a particular risk when the Conservatives and the Brexit Party have at least not yet been able to come to an accommodation. Then, of course, we have the fact that the polarization of the political process remains very much a problem. And these kinds of moves don't generally tend to get better until they get worse first. People generally tend to feel like they have to try something to see whether it works or not. There's a certain element of suck it and see with populism that people feel they have to engage with before they give it up and try to go back to a more technocratic way of managing economies. And we're just not there yet. And this process could go on for a prolonged period. Of course, we also have the additional point that China has given up on its policy of biding its time and gathering its strength. They are now much more active in trying to be more assertive on the global stage. that has created a more difficult period. But there is the additional point that oil prices have been really rather stable. And you don't generally get recessions without a major move in oil prices. Or the other way around it is that oil prices respond to surging global growth by moving higher and then therefore act as a tax on consumption, which eventually leads to some of the excesses that created the bull market in the first place becoming unsustainable. But oil prices might have been steady in here today, and they may have room to rally further if commodity prices do better and the dollar does in fact break its uptrend. There is we're still at the point where it could still rally. If the dollar is, however, going to rally, then we're right in that period right now. I think that the fact that we have had some liquidity issues, that there is an increasing likelihood that the low is in terms of government bond yields, that we've had a rather significant set of clear upward dynamics from the 1.5% level, and that suggests that the low is in terms of the government bond yield. Of course, we're going to have to see it push above the 2% level to clearly break the succession of lower rally highs. It's definitely going to have to sustain a move above the trend mean to suggest that the medium-term low is in fact in. But I do think it is a reasonable prospect that with the quantity of debt that has to be issued, with the fact that they've cut interest rates and are increasing deficits, that if stock markets continue to push higher, then that will remove some of the demand for treasuries. There is the clear potential that we are at the beginning of the bubble phase, that we are going to get a very meaningful move where the potential for massive improvements in productivity growth get priced in, our future potential gets priced into markets within the next 18 months. That's, I think, a very clear potential outcome, that gold can do well in that scenario because it acts as a hedge against that kind of activity. It acts as a stable force against the background where we're seeing massive provision of liquidity entering the market. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.